Dave Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 Podcasting this Network. Was a
triumph. And today we're going to talk about personality. I'm making a note here. And huge next two or three classes, depending. If we get this done in two, we can do, if you want, a review class before the test next Wednesday. Oh, look. What's the controversy there? Someone's celebrating winning a gold medal by having a cigar and a beer. I love it.
I think it's the glasses, honestly.
Maybe it's just the glasses. It's more of a fashion thing. It could simply be that. And, of course, my new desktop image. Just drink it in. Oh, it's the most amazing thing ever. My wife put on Facebook, I have 911 on speed dial in case Canada loses. Up to this point, we've talked about similarities. Really, in general, in the whole course, we've talked, like both in 1106 and 1107. So you think about even 1106, I'm talking about neurons work like this. Memory works like this. Intelligence works like this when you get into 1107. Development back in 1106. Perception. But even in things like the most recent stuff, motivation, emotion, stuff like that, it's all about generalities, all about how individuals behave the same. Personality, on the other hand, deals with individuality, individual differences. It's about how our behavior is consistent over time, but consistent within ourselves, not consistent with each other. Right? So we could think of various different things. In general, there are certain ways that people behave that are consistent within themselves. There are certain ways in general that humans behave, of course. But in general, within each person, there are things about them that are, I shouldn't say unique, but they're specific to them. Okay? So where do these differences come from? Is one of the questions we can ask. Why is it that, I don't know, you can think of almost anything, you know, why is it that some people are calm and some people are excitable? Some people are smart and some people aren't. Why is it that some people are more nurturing than others? Right? These are interesting questions. Where do these differences come from? There are quite a few ideas here. There's everything from, you know, behavior genetics to how much your background, like how you were raised, things like this. There's a lot of different ideas about where these differences come from. And it's a pretty good question, and it's interesting. Probably if we were observing, you know, if there were aliens observing us trying to figure out how humans behave the same way we that study animals look at, you know, this is how chimps behave, they would talk in generalities too. There are individual differences within species, there's no doubt about that. I've even read a paper once on the personality of octopuses. Really did. They got quite a big brain, actually. So, and think about it, like if you have a dog, or if you even have, let's say you have two dogs, and you know they're different, or you've had dogs over time, you know that this dog is different than this one, you know? So there are differences there, but we tend to think dogs are like this. But as humans, because we have this sort of, we're all sort of psychologists, amateur psychologists, we kind of have to be, to get around and get by with each other. Because of that, we focus a lot of times on the differences instead of on the similarities. We don't tend to think of all humans are like this. I tend to think, you know, Jeff's like that or Dave's like that or whatever. Mike's like that. Instead of thinking, well, they're all human. And there's lots of ways to study this. And we'll talk about those over the next couple of days. Right, so you can do everything from giving people a ton of questionnaires. You could talk about the development of their personality, so change over time. You can talk about the consistency over time, of course, as well. Probably the first person that made an attempt that was notable was Sigmund Freud and his psychoanalytic approach. Now, you got to realize, by the way, psychoanalysis doesn't mean therapy or anything like that. What it means is Freudian theory. That's what psychoanalysis means. It means Freud. It doesn't mean anything else, okay? So when someone says analysis or are you analyzing me, they're actually talking about Freud. In the earlier years of psychology, especially in the early 1900s, but probably up to the 1940s, 50s, Freud had tremendous influence in thinking about personality and thinking about, and of course, and when we talk about therapy, thinking about that as well. It's really not as big a deal today in psychology. There are some ideas that one could give credit to Freud for, things like unconscious mind, maybe, perhaps stuff about talking cures, yeah, maybe. But his personality ideas are probably pretty much by academic psychologists thought of as being pseudoscience. It's big in things like literature. A lot of people, I mean, the first time I ran into Sigmund Freud, into Freudian theory, was when I was in an English class in high school. Right? And we were reading the book Catcher in the Rye, which is a great book. J.D. Salinger just died. Great book, Catcher in the Rye. Right? So, I mean, and we looked at that from this Freudian perspective. And I kept saying, but how do you know the author meant that it in this way? What about, what if he was just writing a story, but no one would ever listen to me? And I think it's done some great things for art. There's a lot of songs. The song The End by The Doors is a very Freudian song, overtly so. Freud was a medical doctor, a neurologist, and apparently quite a good one. So he was a practicing neurologist. He also had a cocaine problem, but so did almost everybody back then, and he got over it. He got out of it. Cocaine was a very popular drug in the 1880s, like very popular. The Pope did cocaine. I'm serious. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, Henrik Ibsen. Ibsen, the most depressing playwright ever, did cocaine. I think he wrote most of those plays when he was coming down. So, you know, people make fun of Freud for being on the coke, and I'm happy to do that, except that it was like everybody did it. It was like the 1980s, not the 1880s. Lots of people were coming to his office, and they were sick, but he couldn't diagnose them with traditional methods. Okay? So the problem that was happening here is people would show up, and they would have a classic case. They would have what's called glove anesthesia, where their whole hand would be numb. Their whole hand. And also, they couldn't move it. That's actually impossible. It's physiologically impossible, unless I literally cut your hand right there. Because, especially, you know, you just go with that funny bone right there, you can feel that some of the neurons for controlling this part of your hand, right, your little finger and your ring finger, are controlled by a different part, different set of neurons, than your index finger, your thumb, and your screw you finger. Right? They're controlled by an entirely different part of your nervous system. So it's actually impossible to get glove anesthesia. It can't happen. He also had people come to his office that were blind, except they weren't, there was no trauma. There was nothing wrong with them. Yeah, basically the idea here is it's all, quote, psychological. And of course, if it's psychological at some level, it has to be physiological too, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure Freud even knew that, but traditionally, you know, you'd say, oh, I see why you're numb right here. You banged your ulnar nerve, I guess that's called. And your nerve's pinched, you'll be fine in a few weeks, yada, 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 you're okay. Or if you've got blindness, you'd say, okay, well, did you bump your head, perhaps, back of your head? That could make you blind. Did you have an eye accident of some description? Right, so all these things could have, but they weren't working. And the glove anesthesia was one that Freud just thought, this can't be. I know the nervous system. It doesn't work that way. So he started studying hypnosis and found that he had some success when he would hypnotize people. It was all the rage in the late 1800s, hypnosis. It was something that was everything from being used medically, but also being used, you know, just for traveling shows, interesting things like that. So people were enjoying that. And so he studied it. He studied Mesmer, the guy that's where we get the term mesmerized. And he found out that he could do this, and he was helping some. He was actually helping people somehow. He wasn't sure how, but he'd hypnotize them, and they'd wake up, and they would be able to see or move their hands sometimes. Things like this. Pretty cool. But then he thought, maybe I don't even need to do this hypnosis. This is a long, arduous task. Maybe instead what I can do is get people to just tell me what's on their mind. Right? Just talk. This method's called free association. So the idea here is you sort of relax, close your eyes, and just start talking. And whatever comes to mind, that's what you say. Now, the thing is, this is something pretty, you got to realize, you can't censor yourself. So you know those weird thoughts that come into your head? You got to say those too. So if you ever do this, I would do it on my own with a recorder and record it, or I would do it with someone I trust implicitly. Because, you know, weird things just pop into your head. When you're free associating, you have to just say them. So you develop a trust thing with the patient, and you'd say, look, what I want you to do is just start talking. I'm not going to say anything. Just talk. So people start to, quote, free associate. And the notion here is that some stuff that is, quote, unconscious will get into sort of a pre-conscious area. And because you've got your eyes closed and you're just lying there and doing nothing else but just free associating, that stuff might come out. Supposedly free association then leads to, it gives you a notion of what's in the unconscious part of the mind. Note all the qualifiers, supposedly. It doesn't. But this is the notion Freud had, that this unconscious stuff, the stuff that you maybe don't want to talk about, will somehow creep in. That's what happens during free association. So it's stuff we actually aren't aware of. That's where unconscious comes from. If conscious, you're aware. Unconscious stuff, you're not aware of. So this is the idea, then, that unconscious material kind of leaks in to the conscious, and you just blurt it out. And you're encouraged to just blurt stuff out. That's what you're supposed to do. All right? Questions so far? Does that make... In its own, if you accept everything, it has a weird internal logic. Do you have a question, Billy, or no?
I was just going to make a comment. This is probably where he got a lot of the strained ideas from. He was just listening to what people said.
Yeah, and in fact, it probably was. It was probably partly where he got some of them from doing this with people, and some of them probably just from his own biases and stuff like that. Yeah. So maybe memories might come up at this point. Right? You might get a memory of something and it just, yeah, that happens sometimes. You're just sitting there totally blank. You ever been like that? You're just sitting around? Right? And then suddenly something comes to you out of nowhere. It's like, whoa, my fourth birthday. That's right, I got a water rocket. That was cool. Yeah, and then Dad mounted it and it went 800 feet in the air and then landed and went through someone's roof and we ran. That actually happened to me. That was a little later than four. That was like six or seven. Pretty funny, though.
Did they ever get you? No.
My dad was a strange and wonderful man. I can make this thing take more pressure. So, stuff just comes out of nowhere. And it's more likely to happen. And if you're encouraged to just say these things, it just comes out, you just say it. So just thoughts, any old thought you have. And again, it doesn't matter. You're supposed to say everything. So even if it's things that seem weird. And again, if you ever do this, it's kind of fun. Because weird stuff just pops into your head sometimes. Right? Like the strangest things just pop in. And when you're free associating, you're supposed to say them. You're supposed to say them. It's supposed to get to ideas about your desires. Right? Some of you are sort of thinking about this free association right now, and I guarantee you some of you are thinking, I wouldn't want to say what I just thought out loud. Right? Because they're perhaps asexual things. Now, again, with Freud, he would encourage the patient to just say anything. So the idea here is these unconscious desires you have, these desires to, you know, excuse me, these desires to, like, oh, have sex with anyone, to kill, things like that, things that you wouldn't normally just blurt out, that they're in there, and they're going to come out because you're free associating. So they're sort of in a, temporarily in this pre-conscious area. So they're unconscious normally, we normally don't say these things, they don't come out. And then, when you're free associating, supposedly that taps into this pre-conscious part of your psyche.
This is all still bull, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, none of this is true. But it's one of the things about it, it's important to understand Freud, well, partially because of the impact it's had on Western culture, but also, I think, because it did have an impact on psychology, and there were a few things that he, I guess when you make up enough ideas, eventually the odd one's bound to be correct. There was the odd thing that came out of his mouth that made some sense. He'd also look at dreams, dream analysis. Freud called dreams the royal road to the unconscious. So you look for what's called the latent content in a dream, which is actually supposedly almost always sexual. Freud could turn anything into something sexual. You know, I can see how he would say, if you said, I was having a dream and I was driving a train and then I went into a tunnel and over the tunnel's entrance it said, Mom. I can see him saying that. On the other hand, like if you told Freud I had a dream where I was eating cookies, you say, cookies, eh? Cookies are, oh, you're eating something. You're putting something in your mouth. Well, that's clearly sex. You're having...
The cookies are clearly baked in the kitchen by your...
By your mother! Exactly. It can all be... It all comes back to that. You're made by your mother who made the cookies. By eating the cookies, you're actually having sex with your mother.
Exactly.
You can do this with anything.
Because my dad's a chef and typically made the cookies. What the hell does that say?
Uh-huh. See, now you're conflicted. That'd be $100 an hour for the next 5 years, and we have to meet five times a week. You're buying me a boat. Another one, slips of the tongue, the so-called Freudian slip. There's a classic example of this, sort of as a joke, obviously, on Cheers, when Frasier was a character on Cheers before he had his own show, you know. And someone asked him about his mother. He said, "I don't want to talk about my smother." It was on The Simpsons as well?
No,
but that was on... Frasier did that. Freudian slips are great. They don't mean anything. But a slip of the tongue like that, calling your mother your smother... Ooh. Or pauses. When people would free associate, if they paused before they said something, this would show someone being uncomfortable. Right? Oh, well, that means something. If you're trying to stop it from coming out, that must mean something that's, you know, troubling you somehow. Right? So his friends, I think, called him Siggy. I'm just guessing, but he played guitar. Nothing. Siggy played guitar. The spiders from Mars. Nobody's a Bowie fan. It was Ziggy, I know, but nonetheless. Our personality then arises, according to Freud, from struggles between pleasures and restrictions. Oh, okay. And what we're trying to do is get satisfaction for those pleasures, those pleasurable sort of drives, without getting punished for them. So you have these drives like, you know, for, well, sex. But instead of jumping people, everyone you see, perhaps maybe you get a relationship with somebody that satisfies this urge to screw, but it's socially acceptable. Ah. Well, Sigmund. The notion that Freud had was that there are three subsystems of our psyche that make sure we accomplish this. Right? And they sort of act together. To make sure we accomplish this idea of satisfaction of our urges without being punished for them. Punished societally, punished, you know, just individually, whatever. So the three systems are the id, which is Latin for it. See, it's not even, this is like, it's animalistic, you know, it's not even, like, yeah, id is, it's it, it's not even a individual, it's just this animal nastiness. This is unconscious, nasty psychic energy. This has urges. This is urges like killing and raping and sex and drugs and rock and roll and devil music. I threw the last couple ones in. It's really all about satisfying our need to have sex all the time. So it's like the 70s. This operates on the pleasure principle. If it's there, I'm going to do it. Very hedonistic, right? If it was left up to the id, I couldn't be teaching a class right now because you'd all be having sex with each other. That's what your id's right now. That's what they're all thinking. Like, well, I could have sex with that guy or that girl, whatever. I don't care what it is. What about that chair? I'll have sex with the chair. I got to have sex. Sex is what I do. Anybody gets in my way, I'll kill them. I'll kill them and I'll eat their flesh. I mean, this is raw. This is animal. Remember, this is also all complete bullshit. But it's this idea that we have just this thing, this animal inside us. You like the acting there? It's pretty good, eh? All right. Then there's the ego. That is Latin for I. Except in Latin you pronounce it ego, but like the waffle. The ego's job is, I'm going to gratify the id, but in a reasonable way. Yes, id, I know you want to have sex with everybody, but we can't. It's not reasonable. Right? Why don't instead you go talk to that girl over there? Why don't we go over there together and we'll talk to the girl, and maybe we'll find out, we'll ask her, you know, we'll ask her what her major is, because she's never heard that line before. Maybe we'll buy her a drink. Buy her a drink. Why don't we just have a drink and then just have sex with her and then kill everybody around us? No, no, no. Come on. It's like the two guys on your shoulder, you know, in Animal House or in the Flintstones. You often see that. And then someone else comes, the girl talks to that guy. And it's like, we should kill him. We should kill him. We should eat him and then still have sex with her. Ego's like, well, we shouldn't do that because that could probably get us in a great deal of trouble. And then you'll go to prison. Now, I'm not saying, Ed, that if you were in prison, you wouldn't get any sex, but this thing's operating on the reality principle, right? Now, you can't do that. What you have to do, well, you know how we can make up for it? Okay, you can't have sex with her when she says, but I just want to be your friend. Always every guy's favorite line. Got a lot of that. But I just want to be your friend. Really? Great. Ego's like, that's good. You get to spend time with her. It's kind of like having sex without having sex with her. It'll be good. Really, seriously. Come on, Ed, let's do that. She wants to be friends. We can be friends. Can I stare at her? Oh, yeah, yeah. Just don't be obvious. Don't get caught. Reality is what we care about here. In reality, you can get in a lot of trouble. That's sexual harassment, Id. What's that mean? And then you get superego, who's like the arch enemy of the Id. This is our conscience, you would think of it that way. Superego is saying, both of you should be quiet and never talk about sex. Now be quiet! It's against the rules! This is what superego is doing. Like I said, he's the arch enemy of the Id. He's like, if Id was an evil genius with a cave and a... Freud would love that, by the way. Superego's like a superhero. Really moralistic to the point where you want to just off him. You know? He's like Superman. So the superego is totally the other way. It's as bad as the Id, except it's like this. Don't do anything. Just don't do anything. So you got ego, superego telling you, you can't do anything. You can't go out and just have sex with anybody. Not just, look, Id, it's not that you can't have sex with everybody. You can't have sex with anybody. You can't even think about sex. Sex is bad. And in the middle, ego is supposed to sort of be the referee. Okay, look, superego, we got to keep Id happy or we're going to become a serial killer. And Id, we're not doing anything unless superego lets us. So what do you say? We politely introduce ourselves to that woman over there. I still don't like that it's a woman. Okay. Politely introduce yourself and keep your eyes looking at her face. Don't buy her an alcoholic drink. Alcohol's bad. It's evil. What if I bought her a beer? Beer has less alcohol than like a shot of Jägermeister. Okay, a beer, but make it a light beer. See, so this kind of struggle is what's supposedly, according to Freud, going on all the time. It's always going on. Ego's trying to referee between Id and superego. And it's a delicate balancing act, according to Freud. And this is what makes your personality.
I think this was going on in our heads all the time, we'd all be completely insane.
Yeah, well, perhaps. Well, of course, Freud would say that you're going to have problems if one of these things is kind of out of whack. He'd also love the idea that I just used the word whack. So, if your id's sort of overactive, You're going to have certain issues if your superego is too active. You're going to have certain issues if your ego doesn't develop properly. You don't end up with sort of a good referee. You're going to be all over the place, right? So again, this is Freud's idea. These are these three subsystems of the human psyche. Now, if you buy it, and I don't expect that you do, because I keep telling you it's bullshit, but so I hope you don't. But the interesting thing is, once you kind of buy into it, it has a weird internal logic that almost makes sense. It's kind of like intelligent design. So how does your personality develop then? So according to Freud, we go through a series of psychosexual stages. That's one of the best words ever, psychosexual, where the id focuses on different erogenous zones. These are different parts of your body where you can get pleasure. And this is what forms our personality, supposedly. This is supposedly what forms our personality. I'll see you guys later. All right, I guess they didn't want to hear about Freud anymore.
Might have been the psychosexual.
Could have been that. You think so?
Maybe.
That's what did it in. Not my speech about raping people and killing them. That didn't do anything? Yeah, apparently that didn't do anything.
But.
That's right. So we got these different erogenous zones. The first erogenous zone is your mouth. It's the oral stage. And this is where you get, and this is the first 18 months of your life, and this is where you get gratification through your mouth. And of course, think about it, you're nursing, right? So that's going to give you some gratification. This is the oral stage. So we start out there. Now, at the end of this, there's going to be like a little crisis, because at some point, mom's had just about enough. And at 18 months old, baby has teeth. Hell, baby can talk. And it starts to get weird for mom. And painful. And also, I mean, it's just, eventually the kid's got to stop nursing, right? So, depending on how the weaning process goes, you might either resolve the conflict you have at the oral stage. And again, with most people, that would be the case, right? Eventually, you start eating solid food, you can get some oral gratification from that. It's not as good as boobies, but you know. But some people get fixated here on the oral stage. When you're fixated in the oral stage and you never resolve the conflict properly, maybe you become somebody who speaks a lot. Right? Somebody who's a bit of a loud mouth. So you... Yeah, I was going to say. So it might be like, for example, that I had a very lot of trouble weaning, perhaps. Or if it's somebody, like Freud said, you know, people that smoke. Clearly. Oral fixation. They never resolve the conflict, you see? So they put stuff in their mouth all the time. So people that eat a lot. You know, the weird thing about Freud, though, is, or the opposite, people don't eat very much. Or people that are very quiet. So if you're very quiet, or if you talk a lot, you're fixated in the oral stage. If you eat a lot or don't eat very much, if you smoke a lot or don't smoke at all, and you're like an anti-smoking person, if you drink a lot or don't drink at all, hopefully there you can start to see the problems with Freud. No matter what you are, I can tell you you're fixated somewhere. The next stage is the anal stage. This is from 18 months to 3 years. You get your satisfaction, your erogenous zone is your bum. And this is all about, okay, so you're doing your pooping. It's from the pooping. Freud thought pooping was awesome. Yeah, he did. Says that right in one of his books. It's a footnote. Pooping is awesome. He didn't say that. It was in German, so I don't know what it was. Pooping ist awesome. Yeah! Der pooping ist der awesome. So here what you have. You got eating solid foods, so you're making, you know, real poops. That's the bad part, by the way. For those of you that don't have kids, which is most of you, you know at the beginning when they're just milk, changing their diaper is no big deal. It really isn't. You get used to it very quickly. It's when they start eating people food. and they're making actual turds. That's when it gets a little, And sometime between 18 months and 3 years, you think to yourself, I gotta stop cleaning shit off this kid. We're now going to get it to the point where this kid's going to get him on the potty. We're going to train him. Right? Going to sit him down on there, give him a bowl of pretzels until he poops. That's what my mother did. That's how she trained me, apparently. I was bribed with salty snacks. That'll work for me with almost anything, by the way. Next test, bags of chips. Kidding. That was a joke. However, blank checks and Visa numbers I do take. So again, excuse me. What's happening here? You got a real problem here, because what's you start to toilet train a kid. And Freud said it's very traumatic for little kids. First of all, they lose this freedom of just pooping whenever they want, because pooping feels so good. But they also lose this, when they poop, then they see the crap in the toilet, and then you flush it down the toilet. It's like, oh my God, part of me is gone. So maybe they don't want to lose that part of themselves that, again, keep in mind, is a piece of shit. So this is a part of yourself you're going to lose. You want to keep it in. You become anal retentive. You know that expression? So people that are really neat and clean, we always say they're anal. That's something it's broad. I mean, another reason, like I said, it's had a huge effect in our culture. We talk about people being anal all the time. And that's anal retentive. Somebody who's really neat, really rule-bound. Because it's all about rules. You're not teaching the kid. You can't just poop anywhere, anytime. There's a time and a place for pooping. The place is right there.
Right there, really?
No. Well, yeah. If there was a toilet. If there was a toilet. Well done. That's good. Funny thing is, though, most kids, when they are toilet training, eventually learn this. They get this kind of, they know they're not supposed to be, don't go in their pants anymore, but they do because it's easier and it's less hassle. And you'll see a lot of kids, they'll hide. My little sister used to hide behind a couch all the time. You'd be like, Stephanie, you know, oh, I know what you're doing. I've seen that in so many kids. So maybe right there would be their spot, right? Or, this is the funny thing. So, you know, you have trouble toilet training. Maybe then instead of becoming anal retentive, you become anal expulsive. That means you just want to poop everywhere. You know, like the movie Trainspotting. Anybody seen that? No? Okay. Oh, somebody got it. Thank you. In that case, you're messy. Right? So you got an anal fixation, which also... This is interesting. Again, look, an anal fixation, in other words, your anal retentive, that could make you really super neat and rule-bound. If you're anal expulsive, it could make you rebellious and messy. So two opposite things are caused by exactly the same thing, eh? You can see, I hope, that there's not a lot of predictive value in this approach. So what's happening here then? So this, you get fixated there on the anal stage. Maybe. Again, most of us resolve these things and we're fine. Again, according to Freud. Though we all have little problems, we all need analysis. Freud said we all needed it. It's funny, though, when he was pointed out to him once that he smokes cigars and he must have an oral fixation, and then Freud says sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So, of course, Freud was better than all of us. So that's the anal stage. So that gets done, which is good, you know. Best moment in your life, you don't have to buy diapers anymore. As a parent, it's one of the best moments ever. I don't have to buy diapers anymore.
Well, you don't have to change diapers.
Changing is, actually, you know, the amount of money it costs for diapers, the changing isn't really that bad. When it's your own kid, when it's someone else's kid, you're like, oh, Jesus, oh, why don't you feed your kid? When it's your own kid, it's like you can do it in your sleep with your eyes closed. You actually often do. Then there's the phallic stage. And I'm going to talk about guys here because Freud originally only talked about guys. I'll explain the female one in a second when he came up with that. The phallic stage is now you get focused on your penis. So again, I'm talking about guys here, clearly. And you know, there may be something to this. You ever seen a four-year-old boy wear their hands all the time? Right down their pants. Walking around like that. That's what they do. That's what four-year-old boys do. Got their hands down their pants. They're constantly making adjustments. And this is really around the age, you know, I mean, again, there's something to what Freud's saying here. This is around the age when little boys notice that they have a penis. And they come up to you and say, well, what's going on here? It's like, it's an erection, son. It just, stop playing with yourself. You know, you've... Now, Freud realizes that sex is an inborn thing, and it's something we do. So what Freud says is at this point, we're starting to get pleasure out of this, like it feels good. And we are aroused. We're aroused specifically by our moms. Who's changing your diaper all the time? Who's brushing up against it? It's mom. Mom's kind of hot. This is meant to be creepy, by the way. I don't actually believe this stuff. This is when you go through, you get the Oedipus complex. This is your big thing here. This isn't toilet training. This isn't weaning. This is having sex with your mother. You know Oedipus? Do you know about Oedipus? Do you know the story of Oedipus Rex? I hope you do. Killing your father, getting you, and doing your mom.
Wait, you kill his father and marry his mother?
Yes. It's a play by... Thersites? Euripides? Thersimedes? I don't know. No, he doesn't do it on purpose.
Wasn't there a prophecy or something that said...
There was a prophecy he would. He doesn't do it on purpose. Jeff's right. What happens is he goes away, he comes back, he marries this woman who's a queen of some city-state, and then he kills his father, and then he finds out at the end... spoiler alert, it's been out for 4,000 years, so there's no need for a spoiler alert, I don't think. At the end, he decides, he finds out what's wrong, and he takes a brooch from his mother's, also his wife... from her address, and he gouges his eyes out, and that's how it ends. Oedipus Rex. I think it was Theophanes wrote that. I don't know. Something with the E's at the end. It was a Greek guy. So that's where the idea comes from. Because you see, you get, again, you remember it's like little boys, you're getting all hot for mom. You really want mom. But then something occurs to you as a little boy.
Fucked up.
No. Dad's in the... No, it's because it doesn't occur to you. You know what it occurs to you? Dad's in the way. He's in the way of me having a perfectly awesome sexual relationship with my mother. Yeah. The bright kids are thinking it's fucked up. There's probably no doubt there. So... Wow. Dad'll kill me. I mean, Dad could take me. I'm 4 years old. There's no way. Dad's in his, you know, late 20s. He's a big guy. And he kind of scares me. Unless I laid some kind of trap. So this is where Stewie Griffin, I think, comes from. Except he's trying to kill his mom, which is interesting, yeah. So, there's no way I can get mom. I can get a girl just like mom, though. That's what I want. I want me a girl just like mom. Oh, you know who got a girl just like mom? Dad. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to act like dad. And this is where you start to see little boys imitating their fathers, right? Playing with toy tools and pretend lawnmowers and all that great stuff. Okay. That'll work. And that's how you supposedly resolve the Oedipus complex kind of crisis, right?
This didn't seem completely full of it. Then.
No, the funny thing is, to some people it did, not very many. The thing is, if you buy, like I said, if you buy into this, it's got a really strange internal logic.
It's also really sick.
It's, yeah, but see, you know what Freud would say while you thought it was sick?
You're repressing.
Yep. Now, see, girls, for no apparent, Freud realized, oh, damn, I haven't talked about girls. And actually, most of my patients are girls. Women. So what I'm going to do is I got to figure out how this is going to work. A large number of Freud's patients through free association and what his analysis of their dreams reported incestual relationships with their fathers. Now, Freud knew this went on. People knew it went on. But it is pretty damn rare. And he thought, there's no way that all these women in, like, society in Vienna are getting raped by their fathers. I know what it is. This is actually an unconscious desire to have sex with their fathers. See, what girls want, and he just sort of made sense to Freud. Girls want a penis. They have penis envy. Right? As Elaine once said on Seinfeld, I don't know how you guys walk around with those things, but this is the idea. Girls want penises. So, well, the penis they really want is the one attached to dad. That's the most readily available penis. So what do girls want to do? They want to off their mother and sleep with their father. Again, now they realize, now mom is an obstacle. I could attempt to kill mom. The problem here is that I will lose. There is no way I can take mom down. But you know what? I bet I could get a guy like dad if I just acted like mom. So girls then identify with the female in their life, which is their mother, so they can get a penis just like the one attached to dad. It was never explained why. This is the one part of, even if you buy into the other logic, it's like, why do girls want penises? Why? Where the hell would that come from? Well, who knows what's talking there? Because it was just like out of Freud's, like, I don't know. Oh, I know what it is. Girls want penises. Sure, that makes a lot of sense. I'll write that down. Yeah, well, no, see, he was off the cocaine for at least 20 years when he thought this stuff up. So you've resolved this by identification. And all this goes into what's called latency until puberty. And when puberty happens, you go through what's called the genital stage, and that's mature sexuality. We're supposedly all in that place now, where instead now of wanting to do your parents, one or the other, what you're really after here is a committed, lovely, wonderful, societally acceptable relationship. All right. Questions so far about this? Yeah, ooh, yeah, sorry, you got a question?
Did Freud ever have something
to do with it? No. There's no evidence that he ever did, no.
So he's not just projecting.
No. There's no evidence that he ever, no. He would tell you if he was standing here right now that, however, he knows that he must have, because all little boys do, wanted to. He would tell you, though, that this is the Oedipus complex, would be something that everybody goes through. Or the one for the females, by the way, is called the Electra complex. Electra was, it's a play like Oedipus Rex, except it's for girls. But the protagonist is a female, and she kills her father, kills her mother and sleeps with her father, basically. It's not quite like that, but it's close enough. Though he didn't call it the Electra complex, somebody else did, I think. Other questions? That was an interesting question. All right. So when we have unresolved conflicts, we fixate on those stages, and we try to still satisfy, we try to resolve the conflicts, but we try to do it in some other way. So if you have an unresolved Oedipus complex, you don't try to have sex with your mother. Maybe you try to have sex with as many women as you can. Aha! If you have an unresolved oral fixation, right? Oral conflict, right? So you have fixation, oral fixation, maybe, as I said before, maybe you end up going into public speaking. Now, Freud said the thing is, you see, we can't, and no one does, go around saying, if they have like an anal fixation, they don't go around saying, you know what I really like? I like holding my poop in all day. No one says that. They have these defense mechanisms. And what these are used for is to get us through daily life. So we're able to satisfy the fixation. And this is where the personality part sort of comes in, right? Because now we're satisfying our fixation by other means. So we have things like repression. One of the ways is just don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Just put it away. Just put it away. And this is where I always, you know, if people want to, you could ask if you want to have sex with the parent of the opposite sex, and everyone says no, and I say that proves my theory. You're repressing. Of course, had you said yes, I would have said that proves my theory, and I would have called the police. There's regression. You might actually go back to that stage. So you might have someone who has an oral fixation that still quietly, without anybody knowing, sucks their thumb. And you might know somebody, or you might be somebody who, you know, even to this day, sucks their thumb. There are people like that. Or people who get really excited about going to the bathroom. I've known one person like this. He used to inform you when he walked by your office, I'm going to take a crap. It's like, why are you telling me this? Not here. Different school. I think he mostly did it just to see what people's reaction was. He was that kind of guy.
That's a fun guy.
Yeah, he was awesome. He was an amazing man. One of the best friends I ever had. You might get a reaction formation, which is like you then become the opposite of what your fixation is.
Where we get into non-science part.
Oh, heavily, right? Because you could either, like, if you have a reaction formation kind of thing against being anal retentive, you would then become messy, or you might just be anal expulsive. Damn. See, it's really, really silly. It's really silly. You might have projection. You know, I'm not messy, you're messy. That's projection. Now, you got to realize you're not aware you're doing these things. According to Freud, these defense mechanisms are completely subconscious. This is basically, it has one problem, unresolved conflict. Superego's like, you can't even act like anything in public. And ego's like, what if we did this? Oh, okay. What if we just told everyone else they had a problem? That's projection. You can just rationalize stuff. Now, again, this isn't like, you know, when you say, you might say something and say, well, of course, I know I'm rationalizing. Like when my old MacBook Pro last term, when it stopped working, and all I had to do was reinstall the software, but I took that as a reason to go buy a new one. I'm just rationalizing buying a new one. I was well aware that I was doing that. This isn't something you're aware of. Okay? So you do some behavior and you rationalize it, but you're not aware that it's something that you're sort of making excuses up, right? Maybe you masturbate a lot and you think, well, and you say to yourself, well, everybody else does this, it's no big deal. That is rationalization, if you really believe that. By the way, that's true. Data pretty much show that. But in Freud's day, it probably was true too, but people didn't admit it. We know from Kinsey and stuff like that it's probably the case, right? You might have displacement where you do something else. Well, somebody who's anal expulsive might become very creative. Might paint. Become a sculptor. Oh, look, modeling clay is like poo. Maybe someone who's got an unresolved Oedipus complex becomes, an artist drawing naked people. Or even drawing anything with any curves on it, because that's like a naked woman. Huh. Wow. And again, you're not aware you're doing this. Like, again, according to Freud. So Freud wouldn't think that people are saying, I have an unresolved Oedipus complex, so I'm going to draw naked women. You know. Well, it sort of is in that case, but I mean, in this case, you've actually got a behavior that you that replaces the thing. So, for example, like I said, sculpting is the classic example that's used for an anal fixation. These are all unconscious. You're not aware you're doing them. These are all terms, by the way, that are totally in the popular culture now, right? You've heard about repression. You've heard about people saying that they're regressing. Projection is something you hear a lot. Rationalization, where we tend to use it now, meaning making up excuses. Freud meant that too, except you weren't aware of it. You'll even hear people say things like, little less, but you'll hear displacement and reaction formation even. Right? But you're not, you got to realize, according to Freud, you're not aware you're doing these things. And this is the hard part. And this is what makes your personality then, according to Freud. This is what makes you who you are. The way you resolve unconscious conflicts is what makes me different from you and you and you and etc. So you have to go through all this analysis to find out what the problem is. And then eventually the therapist, the analyst, tells you what your problem is. And that makes you, well, basically a better person. You have a lot less of this sort of psychic tension between the id and the ego and the superego. But this is why we're all different, is because we all satisfy these nasty urges in different ways. That's the first thing. And we are fixated on things that we didn't have a very good time resolving. All right? Questions about that, about Freud? Nothing like this. Why do we have, I mean, how does it actually work as far as personality goes? We'll talk about that, but it certainly isn't the case that any of this is remotely true. There were dissenters, this is good. So even people back then, it first came out and people were like, you guys, you're nuts. But there were dissenters. Erikson, we talked about Erikson. Remember the psychosocial guy in the identity crisis? I even kind of like that. Erikson said, look, it can't be all about sex, Sigmund. And he studied with Freud, you know. But he said, I think it's probably more about social conflict. Remember the identity crisis, generativity, all those things we talked about? We talked about development way back in the first term in 1106. So Erikson said, no, it's psychosocial, not psychosexual. Erikson also said, it's also not all unconscious. It's not all unconscious. It's one of these things where, look, if you ask, you know, candidly someone who's in their 60s, what are they concerned about? They'll say, you know, did I do something good for the world? And they say, why? You know, generativity. Why? Well, you know, I'm getting near the end of my life and I like to look back and think that I did something good. I mean, that's just sensible. So it's not like it's just some unconscious urge. It was Carl Jung who was completely even almost more insane than Freud, who believed that we had a universal unconscious and archetypes. If you think of universal unconscious being the things that are in our evolutionary past that make us, but that's not what he meant. I've heard people try to kind of say that. That's not what he meant. Jung is about as likely as the backstory for Assassin's Creed, that we have these genetic memories. You know, it just doesn't seem likely. Jung was also a bit crazy. Jung also inspired, I don't mean like he was actually certifiably crazy. I mean, he was like Freud crazy. You know, like, you'd look at him and go, what? Jungian stuff has inspired a lot of great art as well. Books by Robertson Davies. You know, you think about Fifth Business. It's all Jung. If you know a little bit of Jung, it makes the books more fun to read. The album Synchronicity by the band The Police is all about Carl Jung. And there were others, quite a few others that dissented. They were still sort of in the analytic tradition, but they said, look, it's not all sex. How do you measure this kind of thing? Well, you measure it using things like the Rorschach test or the TAT, the thematic apperception test. Thematic apperception. The Rorschach test is basically the classic ink blots, right? The ink blot test. So I show you a bunch of ink blots, and I say, what is the first thing that comes to mind? And, of course, because they're ambiguous, the notion, the sort of Freudian notion here is that you interpret them based on your unconscious urges. So maybe you might make a lot of responses about, let's say if you got an anal fixation, a lot of responses about cleanliness and neatness and all this stuff. I see someone cleaning up a room. The TAT are pictures that are ambiguous. So they're actual pictures. And you're asked to either just describe what you see, and then, of course, you put your own spin on it, obviously, because they're ambiguous. Or sometimes you might be asked to write a caption. There's even a kid's version of the TAT that has a little dog in it. I can tell you a couple things. First of all, they don't measure anything, really. It turns out that even though there are even measurement schemes for the Rorschach and the TAT, there really are. It's not just random. But they don't do anything. They don't do any predictive. There's no predictive value in them. And the way I score it may be different than the way you score something. Though there are these ways of scoring the Rorschach that are kind of consistent with each other, but they still don't predict anything. So it's a measurement instrument that measures nothing. Then we talked about validity and reliability. They have a problem, these kind of what are called projective personality tests. They have a problem with reliability, which can be kind of taken care of with various scoring schemes, but even when they're reliable, they're still not valid. They don't predict anything. I have a friend who's a clinician, and when she first opened up her practice, when she got to graduate school, she was trained that all this stuff was crap and all that stuff, and the idea of people having to lie on a couch, which you typically don't do. You tend to sit in a chair. So many of her clients would come in wondering when they're going to get Rorschach tests and where her couch was, that she actually bought a couch, which no one lies on. But she got a couch because it was supposed to, it's a psychologist's office. And she does the Rorschach test and doesn't even write anything down. It just gets people talking. It's the only reason she uses it. She shows people ink blots because they expect ink blots. She doesn't write it down. She doesn't, care about it. I imagine if every single one, when someone said, that's the time I killed my kid, they'd probably go, okay, she'd probably read something into that. But typically she doesn't care. It's just a way to get people talking. So she uses it as a tool, but not as a measurement tool, as a way to get people talking because they expect it. And she even tells people, there's nothing to this. Well, I want to do the ink blots. It's important. Okay, we'll do the ink blots. What do you see? So these tests are about as reliable and valid as the farmer's almanac. Make enough random predictions, something's bound to come true. It's going to be a cold winter. Unless it's warm. That's your farmer's almanac. It's my farmer's almanac guy. You like that one? That's good. I'm glad you like that. I haven't brought up farmer's almanac guy yet this term. That's good. Corn's going to grow this high or this high, depending on the phases of the moon and my biorhythms. Right? Okay. I'm not going to... There's just two people in the room that are liking it, so... So you can see that not really the best approach to personality. But an important one to know, as I said, there's a lot of references to Freud in popular culture. But it's also, it was the first attempt. I don't want anybody leaving this room, walking around, trying to now, quote, analyze people and say, you must have an overactive id. That's just ridiculous.
Can we do it to, like,
piss them off.
Oh, that's fun, and feel free to do that just to bug people. Okay. Yeah, I think that's awesome.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. Make sure at some point, though, you tell them that it's a lie. I didn't say right away. I just said at some point. You know, it's just ethical behavior. On that note, we'll talk about some stuff that's a little bit better than this on Wednesday. Thanks, guys.
I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture science. We do what we must because we can. For the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense crying over every mistake. You just keep on trying till you run out of cake. And the science gets done and you make a neat con for the people who are still alive. I'm not even angry. I'm being so sincere.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.